Hello and welcome to the Marshy Cast. It has been another busy week on the show. So if this is your first time listening, hi, I'm Paul Marsh. This is my podcast. Basically, this podcast is my best interviews of the week. I host a daily radio show weekdays on Express FM from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. If you want to listen live, you can listen to all the usual ways, FM, DAB, online and our app. But if you can't listen live, that's okay, because that's exactly what this podcast is for. Like I say, I bring you my best interviews of the week for you to listen to whenever you see fit. So on this week's episode, I spoke to Charlotte Coben, the writer and creator of the latest Prime TV series, Dead Hot. Charlotte is the daughter of the legendary Harlan Coben. Now, Charlotte and I spoke about her new show and its amazing cast. We spoke about the bonkers plotline and how it reminded me very slightly of a recent film. I also asked Charlotte what her next project might be, and, well, her answer may just excite you. I also spoke to Spurs and Chelsea legend Graham Roberts, who's touring the country with Mickey Hazard, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Tottenham UEFA Cup win, and they're also coming to Portsmouth in April. And then finally, I spoke to Kern Brantley, who is a bass player from Detroit, and he has played with some of the biggest names in the business, and he has got a brilliant story about Michael Jackson. We also spoke about the music scene in Detroit, but first of all, let's speak to Charlotte Coben. It's Paul Marsh here on Express, delighted to say that I've been joined by Charlotte Coben. Charlotte, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you are the writer and creator of a new comedy thriller, which is going to launch exclusively on Prime Video in the UK and Ireland on the 1st of March. You must be very excited.
Oh my God, there are absolutely no words. I can't believe it's happening, but I'm very happy that it is happening.
Right, so I'm going to do the generic tell me about the show question, but I'm actually really genuinely interested to hear the answer because, wow, the TV show throws you in so many different directions. I want to hear your take on it.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, thank you. That's very exciting to hear. So how to describe Dead Hot? The story, we follow Jess and Elliot. They have a shared loss in Peter, who was Jess's twin brother and Elliot's former lover. And now we're 5 years past that. Elliot's finally starting to move on. He goes on a great date, and all of a sudden, you know, all this wild stuff starts to happen, and they realize that the questions they had for 5 years about Peter might be closer than they thought. I forgot to mention that Peter left behind a severed finger in a puddle of blood, so there's that element to it. So we know he didn't just run off and is having a good old time. Something bad. He is fingerless somewhere. Or whether it's in the ground or out in the world.
Well, look, I won't, without sort of giving away any spoilers, I'll tell you where I am at the moment. Last night I watched episode 5, so I got to the end of episode 5.
Oh my gosh, you're deep in it.
And I jaw hit the floor and I'm like,
oh my God, I know that episode 5 ender is, my siblings got to watch it and they all text me. They're like, you're sick. You're messed up. Thanks, guys.
So you had the UK premiere last night in Liverpool. How did that go?
Oh my God, it went really well. We had a lot of students in the audience and they were laughing at all the right parts and even parts I didn't know that people would be laughing at. They really seemed to appreciate some of the text, the double texting of a first date. They were cringing out loud, which is exactly what you want to hear. I'm really happy with how it went and with how it's being received.
It feels like a very young show. Was that always your intention to really capture the youth of today?
Yeah, absolutely. When I wrote the first draft, I was a little more youthful. I was 25. I'm 29 now, not 30, 29. I got one more month of having a 2 in front. So yeah, I was just trying to write a story that felt like a world that, you know, my friends and I live in and how we'd react to thriller moments and, you know, the kind of mysteries that we could get ourselves wrapped up in. Back in my youth, a couple of years ago, was it 3 years ago, 4? I don't know. Very recently, but.
Now, obviously, after working on various projects with your dad, how much pressure was there for you to do this one on your own?
You know, I didn't really feel the pressure. I felt more like the excitement to kind of get to, you know, do a story and my tone and with my voice, and I love working on shows with him. It's always a blast. But you know, you're writing an episode that has to be cohesive with anywhere between like 2 to 4 other writers. So getting to just, you know, go totally wild on the page was very, very exciting.
Now, you didn't direct this. You're the writer and the creator. I know that you didn't direct it. I know that, were you there on a daily basis? How much kind of input did you have on this?
Yes, I was there on a daily basis and talking to the directors a lot. Of course, like letting them do their thing, and the way they brought certain things to life is better than I ever could have imagined. But you know, I was involved in pretty much every aspect. My favorite part to be involved in was all the graphics, like making sure the texts, like I'm like, we wouldn't text like that. That's not the right emoji. So that was really fun to work on. But yeah, no, definitely very hands-on.
I always think it's very interesting when you're making anything like a TV show or a movie or whatever it is, because you know if you're an actor or the director, you have real hands-on right the way throughout the process. You are able to change things when you need to change things. I always think it's very interesting with writers. Obviously, you've written this script, you have it in your head how it's going to look and how it should be. And then, if you're not involved in the day-to-day project, when you see that finished product, are you happy with it? Are you not happy with it? Do you think, well, I like it, but it's not how I envisaged it going? You know, what's the, when you see that final product, what's it like compared to the start of the journey?
You know, sometimes it comes out in a way you aren't expecting for sure. And with this team, though, I'm dead hot. Like, there were some days, you know, I wasn't there. And the directors we had Sam Arbor for Block One and David Sant for Block Two. And I just like trust them with my life, literally. And everything they made, like, I'd have con you have a lot of conversations beforehand, but they really delivered and were so creative and so funny. In previous shows, yes, and it's not always how you picture, but you know, being on set definitely helped make it a little closer for sure.
Now, the cast is phenomenal.
Oh my God, they pop off. I love them.
Did you have a wish list? How involved were you? How did the casting begin?
Yeah, was super involved in the casting. We had an amazing casting director, Ree McDade-Wren, and they just, oh my, the people they found. So it was myself, Sam Arbor, the director, and Lori Kirkham, the producer, and then Nicholas Schindler, the other executive producer. And you know, it's just like watching tape after tape after tape. And I think we had like, oh man, there were so many for Jess and Elliot, and a lot of the characters, like you watch these tapes, you're like, oh man, I love that person. They'd be perfect for like this role. Like, for example, the character who play Marcus, who plays Will, tried out for Elliot, and I was like, oh my God, like he's got to be Will. He's so just like lovable and charming and handsome and just perfect. And yeah, I mean, in terms of like, you know, Penelope Wilton and Peter Serafinowicz, like they were, you know, at the top of the wish list. So it was very exciting to have them say yes and get to
I
do
would imagine that's really difficult to I mean, obviously, you know, luckily enough, your name carries a little bit of you know,
it.
a little bit of cachet with it, doesn't it? So that, you know, if it lands on somebody's doorstep, they're going to certainly acknowledge it and read it and everything else like that. But when you have a wish list of actors, it must be very nerve-wracking to think, you know, this I envisage this person playing this role, and if they say no, I don't know what we're going to do.
I know. Thankfully, I'm not too involved in the like proposal of it all. I don't have to be like up front there if there's any rejection. But yeah, no, it's definitely nerve-wracking, and you know, you're checking your email constantly, like, oh my God, what did Penelope's people say? And it yeah, it was a dream come true to have them say yeah.
Now, I'll be honest, I hadn't seen Bilal in anything he'd done before, but I thought he was absolutely great in this.
He's
But I'm
so good. I can't.
very, I know, right?
I'm like obsessed with watching him.
I absolutely loved Vivian in Rye Lane. I
Yeah.
thought Vivian is just phenomenal in Rye Lane,
He's so
and I thought
talented.
that she carried a lot of that over into this.
Absolutely. I remember we had put the offer out for Vivian to play Jess, and I went to go see Rye Lane as we were waiting for her response. And I was like, oh my God, if she says no at this point, like, I'm gonna be totally shattered. She's just, oh my God, the talent that girl has is She can make anything sound so real. Like certain lines that I wrote, I like read it on the page and I'm like, oh, is this a little too like earnest? And she would just find a way to say it. And I'm like, no, that was, oh my God. She's so genuine and she approaches the lines in a way that you don't always like envision, but it's always better. So I'm so happy that to work with her. And she's just like a great person off screen too.
She's got so much personality.
Oh
So much
yeah,
personality.
she's so great. She's very special.
Now, where did the decision come to film in Liverpool? Because it has some Liverpudlian characters in it, but a lot of the main characters appear to be from the south, maybe the London area. So how did that all come about?
So the first draft of the first episode I wrote took place in New York, just because that's where I live and that's what I know. And then when I teamed up with Nicola in Quay Street, she had the idea of Liverpool just because it's a really like youthful, happening city. And I think it was just like the perfect world for it. There's, you know, we got the universities there, so there's a lot of people from all over the UK. And just a really like campy, happy, genuine energy from the Scouse people. And yeah, I love the Scouse. They're great.
Now, I read another interview with Peter. I've spoken to Peter before. He's a lovely, lovely man.
Awesome.
I didn't realize about, his Liverpool roots, because obviously, again, when you see him in his various different incarnations, he either plays, a Southerner or an American. So I had no idea about his Liverpudlian roots either.
I didn't either till, you know, we were doing the casting and it was like, oh my God, even better, you know. Like separately from him being Scouse, it was Peter Serafinowicz would be perfect for this. And then that on top of it was like, we got that edge. Hopefully he'll say yes now. But and he did. And yeah, he's great.
Now, I know that these two things were probably filmed at roughly the same time, so I know that you've had no influence from this whatsoever, but I got some real Saltburn vibes from this actually,
Oh my
with the
God,
kind
thank
of
you.
with the secret society elitism kind of thing. I got some real Saltburn vibes from it.
Oh, that's I really, really loved Saltburn, so thank you for saying that. Yeah, no, that was a wild movie and I enjoyed it a lot. We didn't have any bathtubs in this one, but maybe see
Now,
it.
it's probably the only thing missing, to be fair.
I know, like dang.
Mental note for next time, bathtubs needed.
Exactly. Bathtub looking check.
And well, I haven't seen the last episode, so maybe if there's a Barry Keoghan kind of dance at the end, I will see that maybe when it's coming.
I know Murder on the Dance Floor is how we close out too. It's unbelievable.
Now, you mentioned that it is produced by Quay Street Productions. Where did the link come with it? How did they come on board?
So Nicola and I have worked together on the previous Netflix shows. She produced all those and I sent her this script just kind of being like, oh, what do you think of this? And she was like, let's get this made. And she did. And I love Quay Street. The people that she finds to work in her office, like the script executive I work with, Charlie Quinn, and script editor Hannah Collins, they were like, oh my God, like therapists slash God slash like mother and father. And I just adore them. And she really. I love Quay Street. I would love to just work with them for the rest of my life if they'll have me.
Is
But
there, I know that we haven't, Dead Hot is not even technically out at the moment as we speak. Is there anything in the pipeline that you can tell us? What's the next project that you're going to be working on?
I would love to get to keep telling the Dead Hot story. We have some ideas for a possible
Okay.
season two. And I just
Okay.
love these characters, and there's so many ways you can go with them. So hopefully we get to do that. Otherwise, there's always like, I got my document full of ideas and I'm ready to pop off on one of them if I get the chance.
Well, like I say, I'm only five episodes in at the moment, so I've got a couple
That's
more
a
to go yet.
lot. That's, almost
Well,
all.
again, it was fully binge worthy. I started it on Sunday. I did 3 or 4 episodes Sunday, and I did one or two last night. So,
That's so
yeah.
sweet. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that you're enjoying it. And wow. Oh my God. Episode six is a wild ride for sure.
Oh,
Lots
right. Well,
of stuff going on.
there's the hook. There's the hook right there.
Oh
The thing is, when we do, obviously, when we do these interviews, we interview so many people and we get sent so many series. And sometimes,
you'll only get to watch maybe an episode or two, and then you just never get to finish them because there are so many other things that you have to do.
A lot of content out there.
Absolutely 100% something that I need to finish.
Oh my God, thank you. I love to hear that. I hope you'll get the answers to everything too. I will not leave you hanging. I don't believe in that. Morally against it, you will get everything.
Good, good. There's nothing worse than getting to the end of a series and going, what the, but what about the, how did the...
I know. It's, oh my God. It's like blue balls, just horrible. You can't do that.
Charlotte, thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really do appreciate
it. Thank you, Paul. So nice meeting you.
Now, Prime members are going to be able to watch all episodes of Dead Hot anywhere and anytime on the Prime Video app. And as I mentioned at the start, the comedy thriller Dead Hot is going to launch exclusively on Prime Video in the UK and Ireland on the 1st of March. Charlotte, I wish you nothing but the best of success with it. It is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much. That is like so nice. I really appreciate it.
Paul Marsh here on Express. Delighted to say that I am joined by Spurs and Chelsea legend Graham Roberts. Graham, thank you very much for joining me.
Good morning. Well, good afternoon now, I suppose.
Now, Graham, you are most well known for playing for Spurs and Chelsea, but many might not know that you're actually a bit of a local lad who played for Pompey and Southampton youth teams.
Well, I played for Portsmouth youth team. Southampton, I was there as an associated schoolboy. Lauren McMenemy released me. So from there, I went to Portsmouth. It was funny, really. Lauren McMenemy said he didn't think I was strong enough to make a professional footballer. And I ended up scoring 7 goals against them. So that made me quite happy.
I can imagine it did, yeah.
You know, being my own town. But no, I went to Portsmouth. Had a great time there. I actually played centre forward.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I was centre forward there. And, I scored a few goals. I think it was Jimmy Dickinson took over from Ian St. John.
Yep.
We did the apprenticeship there, and then I was going to get signed pro at the end of, I think, my second year there. And we played against Aldershot, and they put me in the team. And a man called Joe Joplin, I came on at half-time. Joe Joplin whacked me on my left ankle and broke my ankle. And from there, Jimmy Dickinson pulled the plug. He wouldn't sign me. He said he would wait until I got fit. But Dorchester Town sort of... took over, and I went to Dorchester, so and then Weymouth, and then Tottenham.
Well, take me through those 3 years, because obviously you were a young lad, and in the space of 3 years, you've gone from Southampton to Portsmouth to Dorchester to Weymouth.
Actually, I went to Bournemouth after Southampton.
Oh, right.
Harry Redknapp, just for probably about 6 months, I think it was, 7 months. I played in their youth team and scored 49 goals.
Oh, wow.
And... at the end of the season, Bournemouth had no money. They were really struggling at that time. And then I went to Ian St. John and Bill, I think it was Billy Hunter, the youth team coach. And, from there I went to Dorchester. Played there for probably a year.
Yeah.
And then the following year, Weymouth made a bid for me. I turned them down it the first time. Because I was enjoying my football at Dorchester and I didn't really want another setback. And I signed a new contract for Dorchester. Then 3 months later, Stuart Morgan, who was assistant coach at Bournemouth when I was there, came in and they paid £6,000 for me. I went to Weymouth, was there for 4 months, 5 months. Maximum, we got to the semi-final, the FA Trophy, second in the league. We were playing really, really well, and I was doing really well. And then I had 3 offers, one from Swindon, one from West Brom, which I was nearly signed. And while I was at West Brom, Tottenham made a bid on the day that I was going to sign for West Brom, and I changed my mind and went to Tottenham.
Well, you certainly made the right move there, didn't you? Because at Tottenham, you spent 6 years winning the FA Cup, but of course, winning, scoring and captaining in the UEFA Cup win against Anderlecht. I mean, if you can put it into words, what was that like?
My ex-wife, she wanted to go to West Brom. So, yeah, I did make the right decision. it was a big decision to make because, you know, Ron Atkinson had sold the club to me. And he thought I had a great chance of getting in the team. Well, I went to Tottenham and it was sort of work hard. And it was about 2.5 months, 3 months before I got into the team. But once I got into the team, I sort of gelled with everybody. And I went there as a midfield player and then sort of they pushed me into centre-back. And that's where I played most of my career. I did play in midfield a few times. I played in the FA Cup 82 in midfield. But 81, you know, being there one season, going from playing at Weymouth in May to playing at Wembley for Tottenham in the FA Cup final against Man City the following year. So it was a brilliant experience. I made the right decision. I know I made the right decision. And, you know, going from there, winning the second FA Cup and then going in 84, being the captain and scoring the goal and winning the UEFA Cup. So nothing gets much better than that. So, yeah, I've had a great career. I still enjoy watching them. And, you know, it's just a pity you get older and you can't play no more.
Maybe not quite to the same level, but I know exactly how you feel.
Yeah, I agree. I agree there.
What are your thoughts this season on Spurs and especially with the new manager, Ange Postecoglou?
Yeah, Ange's brilliant. He's got what the club's about. You know, everybody has a go at Tottenham. They don't win trophies. You know, that will come. You know, what you have to realise in football is there's probably 20 teams in the Premier League and a couple in the Championship who can win trophies. You know, and in the Premier League, there's only one team that can win it, and you've got probably five or six teams fighting for that. And then you have, in the FA Cup, you have all the teams fighting for it, but it usually comes down to the Premier League big guns who get to the finals. And the League Cup, the Carabao Cup, is the same. So, yeah, but he's got the, you know, we've had 3, 4, 5 terrible years. Excuse me. Mourinho came. Yeah, he got us to a cup final and then got sacked. Nobody knows why, but that's the way football goes. Conte came. His football was absolutely horrendous. It was awful. Nobody
very
liked
Italian.
It. Well, yeah, but nobody liked it. The crowd didn't enjoy coming on Saturdays. They got on the players' back. The players, you could see the players didn't like playing that way. And then all of a sudden, Ange's come in and transformed everything. He's got players play now we didn't know they could play like that. I would say one thing that we do lack at the moment is we can see goals in every game. We need some clean sheets, but it's the way he wants to play. He loves attacking football. Yeah. And everybody's, you know, they're on their feet clapping and singing and enjoying their days out at Tottenham.
Well, I certainly enjoy his refreshing honesty, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Can I very briefly ask you about your time at Rangers? It seemed to be a very brief but colourful two-year stay in Scotland.
Yeah, well, it was. I was there for about sort of 19 months. It was a one fallout. You know, I've spoken to the manager since, Graham Souness, and we're good friends. When you're a manager, I've been a manager, so I know where he was. You know, it was just a misunderstanding, but he wanted to stand authority on the club, and I was got rid of. But while I was there, you know, we won three trophies. It was a fantastic time. Lovely club, brilliant supporters, and I enjoyed every minute of it there.
Now, you are back in Portsmouth on the 18th of April at the Royal Thai Maritime Hotel in Portsmouth for the Portsmouth Spurs Official Supporters Club with Mickey Hazard for the 40th anniversary of winning that UEFA Cup. So what can people expect from yourself and Mickey? And I will remind you that this is a daytime radio programme, so you probably can't tell too many of the stories.
No, there's some great stories. Some funny stories, but we're just going over really. We go over all of our career while we played, you know, where we started from. But the UEFA Cup year was exceptional. You know, playing in against Johan Cruyff and people like that, Bayern Munich, we knocked out, and just reminiscing really on our career. And we've done a few at the moment. Everybody's loved them, so you know it'd be a great night out. Whether you're a Portsmouth fan, Southampton fan, any southern team you support, you'll enjoy the evening because it will be a fun night.
Well, I'm sure it will be an amazing night. There are still literally just a handful of tickets left for the evening. They can be purchased from portsmouthspurs.com. Prices are £25 or £30, including a photo. Graham, thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure,
I really
mate.
Do appreciate it, and I hope you have a fantastic evening.
Thank you, and to show. Lovely. Thank you very much.
It's Paul Marsh here on Express. Delighted to say that I've been joined on a Zoom call by Kern Brantley. Kern, thank you so much for talking to me.
Hey, Paul. How are you, man?
Very good, thank you. Now, Kern, I'll be honest with you. Your name is a name that a lot of people might not know. However, without a shadow of a doubt, you have worked on things that the people will know, because the list of people that you've worked with, the list of things that you've done, the list of places you've been to is just unbelievable, isn't it?
Oh yeah, great experience, great.
How was that when you were you know, a young boy in Detroit, crafting your skills, learning the trade? Did you ever imagine? Could you ever imagine achieving the things that you've achieved?
No, I was just kind of doing it just for fun. You know, my family played music, my brothers both played music, so we were just having fun as kids playing instruments.
And what made you did you pick up the bass first, or was it something else?
Actually, I was a guitar player first, but my brother also plays guitar, so he wanted all the guitar parts, so I got kind of forced into being the bass player.
Why does that always happen? Why does it always, the younger brother gets relegated usually?
Yeah. I wanted to be like Jimi Hendrix, and he was like, no, you have to play the bass line.
Well, it worked out well, okay, didn't it? It worked out well.
Oh, yeah.
So you have worked with an amazing list of artists. I'm just going to reel them off if that's okay. I know this is kind of probably a little bit embarrassing, but you have worked with the likes of Beyonce, Lady Gaga, Puff Daddy, Boyz II Men, Nicole Scherzinger, Aretha Franklin, Will Smith, Mary J. Blige. I mean, that's just a few of the names.
Yeah.
Where did it? I know this is such an open-ended question, but where did it all begin? How did your path begin to work with the names of people like these?
It's kind of like a stair step. You know, I actually started in gospel music, playing at church. And through church, my mentor, Thomas Whitfield, introduced me to Marvin Winans and the Clark Sisters. And then Marvin Winans, in turn, did a record with Teddy Riley, who was the leader of the group Guy and the producer of Michael Jackson. From there, Teddy invited me to New York, and then it just kind of snowballed from there.
Wow.
I met Mary J. Blige,
yeah,
and Puffy and a lot of different people out there in New York.
Teddy was the man. Teddy was the man.
Oh, yeah.
Teddy made some tunes, let me tell you.
Yeah. Remember the Time, Michael Jackson. And actually, I met Michael through Teddy. He introduced me to Michael.
Wow.
And we were asking to be Michael's band. Teddy was going to be the musical director for that tour, for the Bad Tour, but he wound up going in a different direction. But yeah, well, we got a chance to meet him and hang out, so it was cool.
What was that like, to meet the legend?
Oh, it was great. We were in the studio, and they were mixing the record Jam, and Michael walked in, and He actually came to our concert that night, and he said the band sounded great. And we were like, "Man, Michael said we sound great. This is awesome."
And Michael was a perfectionist. So if Michael
Oh,
says you're sounding great, you're sounding great.
yeah. Well, Michael's musical director is from Detroit, which is Greg Phillinganes. And Greg was a big idol of mine. I always inspired to be like Greg because he was the musical director for Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson, and Eric Clapton, and he plays with the group Toto.
Okay,
So I
all
always
right. I didn't know that.
Greg, like, wow, you're the man.
So
He's a Detroit.
what was it like to go on tour with these legends? Now, I know going on tour is not like the holy grail of things, because I know going on tour is a lot of, getting on a bus, getting to a hotel, then going to the venue and repeat and repeat and repeat, and you don't really see a lot of stuff. But what was it like to spend time with these legends, and tour with them and work with them?
Oh, it was a great experience. Most of the people I work with, I sit back and observe and learn a lot. Lady Gaga is a very hard worker, and so is Beyonce. So working with those artists on that caliber, you just the work ethic. And we got a chance to do a lot of really cool stuff like Gaga. We had a private plane, so we got to jet set, over to Russia and Africa on our own plane, and then we got to ride on a boat in Turkey, and so it was just, it was great. I think totally I've been to 64 countries
Oh, wow.
touring.
Wow.
Yeah.
And have you seen much of these countries, or like we say, is it all the inside of a hotel room and then the stadium?
A lot at the venue and in the hotel, but what we do on the off days, we would always plan to go on some kind of group, in the Middle East. We're gonna go, let's go sand dune, let's go camelback riding. So we always would try to plan on our off days somewhere we'll get local food and kind of see the culture and try to get out into to the city a little bit.
It's funny you mention about Lady Gaga, because a friend of mine actually produced a fair amount of music for her, a guy called Clinton Sparks. I'm not sure if you know Clinton
I've
at all.
heard him. I don't know him, but yeah,
He's
I heard him.
where's he from? He's from Boston. He's a Boston guy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's done a fair bit of work with her. But anyway, I digress. So when you're working with these artists, and is this something that you're living in the moment on, or are you planning on, using this somehow to further the music development? What were you thinking when you were working with these people?
Well, with those people, it's really more of a responsibility because you're thinking you're playing arenas and stadiums, and as the bass player, I'm responsible for the groove. I'm responsible for the bottom end of that concert. So a lot of times when I'm on these gigs, I'm just thinking of making sure that I'm holding up my
Yeah.
part, and I'm making sure that I'm playing big and that everything is correct and perfect for the audience and for the fans. So it's really more a responsibility thing, and as well as a world experience.
Do you get stage fright as such? Like you say, you talk about the responsibility of playing in front of thousands upon thousands of fans. Do you get that stage fright, that nervousness?
Yeah, I always get a little bit nervous, but as long as I don't have any technical problems, I'm okay. Once the ball is rolling, then it's show, it's party. It's on.
You
It's party
trust
time.
in yourself. It's the equipment you don't trust.
Yeah, because if something goes wrong, then it'll throw you off your balance a little bit. Like, oh, I can't hear myself, or this string broke, and oh my goodness. Yeah.
You, as well as working with some amazing people, you've also sort of played at some really prestigious events. Obviously, the Oscars, the Grammys, two of the the top of the most top things if you're going to work on shows. What was it like being a part of those?
Oh, wow. The same thing, a lot of responsibility. When you're doing television, everything runs on, just like TV and radio, everything runs on time. So everything has to happen in a certain moment, and it may be one take, so everything has to be correct. We do a lot of prep work. We prepare sound checks and we run over it a few times before it's time to actually record or perform. So it's just, whenever I'm on stage, I'm thinking more of my responsibility of holding up my part,
Now, like I mentioned earlier, you're from Detroit. It's obviously rich with musical history. Obviously, it's the place that gave birth to Motown, and
Oh,
then
yeah.
later on, dance music. All came from
Exactly.
Detroit. Now, I suppose the biggest name of recent years would be Eminem to come out of it. And obviously, Eminem didn't paint Detroit in such a fantastic light, did he? Well, I mean, that's a difficult thing to say. He told the truth from his experience and
Yeah.
where he came from. Now, wherever you are in the world, as we know, there are nice areas and there are not some nice areas, and Eminem showed the not nice areas of Detroit. I assume that all of Detroit isn't like that.
No, especially nowadays, we're going through a lot of renovations now. There's a lot of things happening with the Motown Museum renovation. The city is being renovated. We went through a bankruptcy at one time in Detroit. So, you know, it was kind of rough, but the music prevailed. You know, Eminem comes from a part where 8 Mile, which is the borderline between Detroit and the suburbs. So he was one of those kids that was caught right there in the middle of not having enough money to live out. So he had to kind of, but that's what shaped his sound and the fact that he gravitated to the city and hung out with Proof and D12 and all those guys in the hood. And that gave him his sound and his rawness. And then he just took it from there. And
When you were off touring and when you were off doing all your bits and pieces, did you manage to stay connected to Detroit? I know, let's face it, if you're touring the world, and I assume you're probably LA-based, was it difficult to keep that connection with your hometown?
Oh, no, I still live in Detroit. I never moved away.
Oh, wow, okay.
I've never lived in LA. I never lived in New York or Atlanta. I've always been there, but I've always told musicians, as long as you're able to travel, you're okay, you know. So I would go audition. I auditioned for Lady Gaga. I auditioned for David Foster. I auditioned for Nicole Scherzinger. So different artists that I've worked with, I would hear about the audition, and then I would get to L.A. or get to New York or wherever I needed to be. And coming from Detroit, I have a hustler mentality. Like, I have to be able to go and make this happen. And, you know, when you leave Detroit, you take no for an answer. You're coming in and you're going to make this happen.
Like we said, there are so many greats. I mean, you spoke about the Motown Museum and everything else like that. You know, the likes of Michael Jackson and Marvin Gaye, Lionel Richie, etc., all coming from there. What I mean, like I say, I know that Detroit in previous years has been painted as, you know, not exactly a safe city and not somewhere that tourists would want to go. So what would you say for the people that are looking to go and visit Detroit, especially those that have a musical interest?
Oh, wow. They should come. You have to experience it. It's not just Motown, but we have like Third Man Records, the group White Stripe, Jack White, Meg White. They're from there. And they have a record shop that's actually a performance space, as well as a record plant that they produce records as well. Then we have the Techno Museum, where techno music like Kevin Saunderson and house music DJs, Juan Atkins and Jeff Mills, all those guys are from Detroit. And of course, I know you should know about Jay Dilla.
Yeah, of course,
you know,
yeah.
Village. So all these people are right in the neighborhood, so you can go see Jay Dilla one, you know, and you got Slum Village and then late Amp Fiddler and people like that around. And then you had United Sound Studio, which was the P-Funk lab in Detroit, where Parliament Funkadelic and Bootsy Collins and Zapp record all their hits. And it's also the same studio that was owned by Don Davis. So Detroit had Anita Baker, you know, then we had our gospel, you know, I worked with Aretha Franklin and
the legend.
The gospel scene in Detroit was just amazing with Aretha Franklin and the Winans and all those guys. And it's just so many different places. You know, Baker's Keyboard Lounge, which is the oldest jazz club in the world. And it's located in Detroit, where people like Miles Davis and Bob James and Earl Klugh and Grover Washington Jr. would come there and when they're in town. And St. Andrews Hall, where Eminem, you know, got his start at and cut a lot of stuff there. So there's a lot of great spots there to hang out.
So obviously,
you gotta see it.
We talk about the past, obviously, and if the people want to come and visit Detroit and look at the past musical side of it, what about the future? Where can if people want to find, you know, the next artist that's really going to pop out of Detroit, where's those places to go?
Well, there's a place called the Spotlight, which is a lot of underground stuff, and then there's another place that we just call, it's called the Aretha Franklin Cafe, that's inside of Detroit Music Hall. A lot of new artists are coming up there. And then Motown also has a program called Amplify, where we do vocal competition and we do training for young people and upcoming artists. You know, we give them a facility. Motown has just opened up 2 new studios. So that's opening that up to the public for free. And then we have the summer camp for the kids as well. Kids like 14 and up, give them training in music and Motown history. So Motown and the Detroit Music Hall are doing a lot of great things for upcoming artists in Detroit.
That's what we like to hear. As well as celebrating the past, we love to sort of focus on the future as well and make sure that there's still plenty of great music coming through. Kern, thank you so much. It's been brilliant to talk to you. If people want to find out a little bit more about you, they want to find out what you're up to next, where can they do that?
We can go to visitdetroit.com for the things that we're doing coming up. We got Bass Day coming up in Detroit, which is the 250 bass players meeting at the Motown Museum. And then I have my own website. This is KernBrantleyMusic.com.
Thank you so much, Kern. I really do appreciate it. And I wish you nothing but the best of luck. Thank you so much.
Oh, likewise. Thank you. I really appreciate you.
Thank you very much for listening in. As always, it is always greatly appreciated. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please like, share, subscribe, tell a friend to tell a friend. We'll be back next week with another podcast. But in the meantime, if you do want to listen to the show, I'm on every single day, weekdays on ExpressFM from 10 a.m.